are food and sex connected? Not just taking a date to dinner first, but consuming.
Sensation, pleasure, and nourishment. The upcoming conversation with Ken, the sous chef at the 8-Course Gourmet Dinner, is a very juicy tease for the rest of the live and on-location interviews from the Erotic Gourmet Dinner. We'll be talking about everything from caviar to making everyday household objects into BDSM sex toys, how to avoid the thorny bits of sexual freedom and still enjoy the good parts, and a conversation with Midori on how to almost psychically tease the fantasy out of your partner's mind. Now, we'll talk with Ken about the links between food, sex, and meditation, and stroking, orgasmic meditation, full-body orgasms, and gender, and communication, and martial arts. I know, so juicy. So, if being present in the moment makes everything taste better, what does it do to your sex life?
This is sex. Everyone gets what they want. This is sexploration.
Explore. Play.
This is Sexploration with Monica.
Sex is proof that God loves us and wants us to have fun.
Sexploration with Monica at sexplorationwithmonica.com.
So finally, after the souffle, Ken is ready to talk. He's the sous chef here at Our Gourmet Life, the 8-Course Gourmet Dinner. He's also, he practices meditation, not only regular meditation, but sexy stroking meditation. We'll talk more about that. And you practice martial arts.
Yes, I do. Been practicing for most of my life.
And so as you're doing the Our Gourmet Life dinners, as you're in this really erotic environment, it's sexy and it's about cooking, what are you learning about the connections between sex and food?
Well, the connection is throughout most of your life, you're using all five senses. Mm. What you see, you know, is attractive or sexy. What you touch with your skin, what you touch with your tongue, your taste. What you hear, what the food sounds like. And textures. So all of those things matter. You're always using your five senses. So a sexual experience should use all five senses,
right?
According to my experience.
Right. Do you feel like the sexual energy is kind of related to creativity or related to creative energy?
In my experience so far, yes. And the more connected I became to my sexual practices and energy and experiences, the more creative I got in my particular pursuits, which tend to be physical and mental. I'm a mathematician by training, so my mental pursuits are balanced by that as well.
Have the erotic dinners made your life more erotic or more gourmet?
Both.
Yeah?
I'm an erotic gourmet and a gourmet food person.
Well, it's nice because there's a lot of naked people and there's also a lot of foie gras.
Yes, that, and there's nothing more sexy than that. Yeah, definitely there's been an improvement in my life, both in terms of food and in sex. Mm. And they're connected. I mean, it's about taking things into your body, feeling sensation, pleasure. Food can be really pleasurable or it can be painful. And I went through a period of time where food was a bit painful because it was more about an asceticism that I had, that I was trying to purge my body, cleanse my body. And that necessarily can be something that's not about pleasure. Of course, there are ascetics in India who their devotion is not to not have food, to not have pleasure from food. So there's a different kind of awakening you can have, but I'm in this phase of my life where I want awakenings from taking in, from pleasure. So taking from or not having things can be an awakening experience or provide awakening experience or path to awakening. But in my experience now, pleasure is also a path of awakening.
Let's talk about the connection between being present in the moment and pleasure. Why is it important to be present in the moment when you want pleasure?
Well, when you're present in the moment, there are subtle things that happen. During my experience and what I've learned, in every human experience, there are subtleties that we can miss if we are having our attention 5 feet away when something's happening in our hand or in front of our eyes or in our nose, you know,
or 5 minutes ago.
Or 5 minutes, right,
or
yeah.
5 hours ago, right.
Right, and we can get tied up in the time and space. So, and the past has already happened and the future hasn't happened yet, but the present is currently existing. And so that's what we can interact with. We can't have a direct interaction with things that have happened already.
So can you use being present in the moment as a way to become more responsive, to feel more?
Yes, so far that's what I felt. I've decided to make that a lifelong practice, to be in the moment as much as possible, to go beyond what my ego trip is. Frankly, this morning I was in the shower and I was thinking, well, if I let go of trying to control my ego or destroy it, what I'm actually doing is guiding it instead of having it guide me, has been my experience after the meditation and the years that have gone on since then, is that things don't bother me the same way they did when I was younger, because my ego is not deciding for me. My ego is my servant, and I look at it that way. So being present in the moment, I'm able to attend to my ego when it wants to go its own way. And we need to go in the same direction, and I'll be guiding that direction.
Right, right. So let's talk about the different kinds of meditations that you've done.
Mm-hmm.
You've done Vipassana.
Right, yes.
And you've also done like a stroking meditation.
Yes, a meditation that involves sex per se, but not, it's not sexual, the sexual act itself.
So let's describe both. We'll start with Vipassana and then we'll get to the stroking. Vipassana, you did the 10-day retreat.
Yes.
And it's very ascetic. It's, you know, 11 hours a day of meditating, mm-hmm. no dinner. You don't make eye contact or speak to anyone for
right.
10 days.
Yeah, it was very challenging. And I think about the third or fourth day I had this experience. I woke up in the middle of sleep screaming.
Oh.
And I thought, and it was really funny. And it was really funny the morning after I went back to sleep and woke up, I thought, wow, that felt like an ego death of some sort.
Interesting.
And it was like some ego trip I was in that was fighting not to die. I don't think it died, but later when the session was over, when the 10 days were over, the guy who was rooming with me, I asked him, that third night, did you hear me yelling? He's like, oh, I heard you wake up, but you weren't yelling. But in my mind,
in
I thought
mind.
I was screaming. I thought I was screaming for like 5 minutes. I woke up screaming.
Huh.
And it was really funny.
That's weird.
So yeah, it was an ascetic practice that I feel like it kind of squeezed extra oil out of me or something, you know, like an extra oily piece of food and you squeeze it and, you know, you get a gallon of oil out of a biscuit.
Yeah, all sorts of weird things happened to me when I did the Vipassana meditation. First of all, I rebelled by doing yoga, which is very weird. I'm usually like making myself go to yoga, right?
Yeah.
And then I had this experience of explosive, seductive sexual pleasure with a pear, just waiting for a pear to ripen. I had a pear on my windowsill, and every day we would have pears, but they would always be underripe. And so I was like, I am not going to have one more underripe pear. So I secretly brought this pear into my room, and every day I would smell it. And they don't give you a lot to do because you don't get to read,
right.
You can't write. I mean, it's all the process of trying to get you out of your mind and to start mm-hmm. thinking about the mental chatter that we are always distracted by.
Yeah, it was very difficult, particularly my martial arts practice. I can do it standing still or anywhere. It's almost a compulsion
mm-hmm.
to do it. I can't stop moving. So that was really challenging. But the experience really helped my martial practice because I got more engaged with it
mm-hmm.
and was more present to what was happening in the moment. So mm-hmm. it was almost this supercharge that happened in my understanding of even what I was doing. Because you couldn't, I got caught one day. I was like, what are you? No doing that.
Right.
But I wasn't.
He did the yoga secretly in my room. And
yeah.
push-ups. I'm not a push-upper.
Yeah.
You know? And I'd walk by that pear and I'd kind of smell it and I'd be like, oh, soon, my pretty. Then when I ate it, it was like, oh, this marvelous, just juicy, orgasmic pear. I mean, it was just a pear.
Yeah.
But it became, you know, so much. So let's talk about stroking, which is also mm-hmm. a form of meditation.
Right.
But it's centered on the sensations of genital stimulation. There are a couple of different kinds of stroking practices. There's the pleasure expansion technique or petting, orgasmic meditation, oming. There's a bunch of them. Deliberate orgasm, doing. Expanded orgasm, full body orgasm, extended orgasm. Anything that you hear or you can search on the internet, like extended massive orgasm, extended sensual orgasm, whole body orgasm. All of those are different kinds of stroking practices. And what's really interesting about them is that they can just bring you to a whole new level of sensual sensation, because you're really focusing, you're really dialing your mind in on the, you know, the subtle sensations of your clitoris being stroked, sometimes not so subtle when you're beginning to pay attention. And it's so rewarding, because when you actually are really focusing your attention on the subtle sensations of your clitoris being stroked, it suddenly feels even better.
Yes.
So it's an easy reward. It's not like Vipassana meditation where you're doing it and you're like, oh, I feel the tiny, tiny vibration of my cell being alive. I mean, it's cool.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like a fire in your loins that's spreading all over your body.
Absolutely. I think what I learned in Vipassana was... I translated it to the more sexual meditation, and the same idea is just focusing on one point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our genitals bring the most sensation in our lives physically.
Yeah, they're big nervous centers.
Right. So being able to focus.
Although our mouths are very.
Oh yeah, yes, yeah. I was gonna say our tongues mm-hmm. are pretty sensitive, mm-hmm. and lips, but there's something about being able to focus on being stimulated there,
mm-hmm.
that as you learn to not lose control, to jump into like fantasy or rush towards culmination of the experience,
rush towards orgasm,
right? Or shall, because by my understanding and learning, the orgasm is always happening. It isn't just this one thing, but we equate it with climax.
Right.
And climax and orgasm would be two different things. So the rush to climax is often what we go for in sex, whereas if you can learn to prolong the experience that comes before climax, sex is a much more interesting process. And that's also where the enlightenment from pleasure can come,
mm-hmm.
because you're learning to attune and you sort of drop down on a micro level, almost on an atomic level of attention,
mm-hmm.
that for me is expanded time in a way. And greatly expanded my sensitivity to non-physical awareness, if I could say it that way. I mean, it's not that mystical. It's just extending what you see, because we see things all the time. There's micro expressions we do when we communicate.
Oh, facial expressions.
Right.
Yeah.
And so if you're well attuned to that, it's not like you have to touch someone's face.
Mm-hmm.
But then someone who's blind, if they touch your face, they can sense things about what's going on with you that people who can see you can't.
Mm.
So there's all these subtleties of sensation that we get through our direct experience and expanding our nervous system that can benefit us in a lot of ways.
And I think that we sometimes lose the sexual and sensual sensations and the pleasure of sex when we're rushing towards orgasm, when we're rushing towards climax. And so many stroking practices redefine, instead of thinking of orgasm as the climax, just the climax, they say, well, the entire process is a process of orgasm. So did you think that do you think that stroking is sex or not? Not really. In what ways is it sex, and in what ways is it not sex?
Well, I mean, technically, you have to determine what is sex.
I know, it's a big question.
I mean, for some people, oral sex is not sex.
I know.
We can ask Bill Clinton about that one.
I know, right?
Like,
lesbians can never lose their virginity.
Right. Mm. But
I don't know.
But the way I say it is this. If sex is anything that you're doing with someone that you wouldn't do with your mother
or
your brother or in some areas of the world, that isn't even a qualifier. But there is a distinct reason, and I said this with a female friend once, because she was asking me about a guy she was seeing, and she was trying to be careful with him, so they only did oral. And I said, well, you know, we're close friends, so if you're doing something with him that you wouldn't do with me, because we have more like a brother-sister type of relationship at the time, then that's sex.
Yeah.
Which is pretty intimate. So.
Well, and it's interesting, though, because I think people do put different values on different kinds of sex.
Right.
Like if it's just an external sex or if it's penetration, it does mean something different for some women. Like,
right.
And I think that sometimes women do put like more expectation, because something that used to happen to me when I was... well, before I had a radio show about sex and got educated about it, you know what I mean? I used to think that if someone never talked to me again after I had penis-vagina intercourse with them, that it somehow damaged me or made me, or it would make me feel sad or discarded. But if I didn't have penis-vagina intercourse, if I only made out with them or if they only went down on me and I only went down on them, then it wouldn't make me feel degraded.
Right.
I mean, not that sex is degrading, but that's the message that I got, you know, from whole slut-shaming thing.
Yeah, totally. I think what that is there's, it's the emotional component.
Exactly.
That makes the difference between whether you regard what you're doing as having sex or not.
Mm-hmm.
If you're emotionally involved, then of course that intimate of a physical contact is going to color your perception and create expectation. But then we're back to being in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have any expectations, if you don't go in with expectation and you allow a relationship, even if you slept with someone the first time you met them, you can allow the relationship to develop, and that doesn't have to be a barrier to further development.
Right.
And then for a long time, I had experiences of making friends with women, wanting to develop friendships and never crossing a sexual boundary, and eventually losing them because I didn't make a move. Or when I finally made a move, they were like, oh, I don't think of you that way.
I know, isn't that funny? They're like, no, you're like a brother to me. And you're like, wait, how did that happen? So when you were doing this stroking practice, you were kind of living with a bunch of people in kind of a group situation, like an urban retreat center, and you would actually practice quite frequently.
Yeah, I practiced twice a day was the practice, and then sometimes I would do it three or four times.
Now, were you a receiver of stroking also, or just a giver of stroking?
At a certain point, when I began, it was only the women. I was only stroking women or touching women. And then at a certain point, I was being stroked as well. And that definitely was a different experience. Being touched that intimately by a woman, but with no expectations or goal, particularly in mind. And there was a certain freedom in that. The emotional attachments started to melt away. I found myself becoming less afraid of becoming emotionally attached to having sex with someone.
Could you say more about that? You had fear about having sex with someone, or you had fear about having sex with someone and then having expectations about it, or not? I didn't quite understand.
All of that.
Yeah. No, I know. There's a lot in there.
Yeah.
Let's try to unpack it.
Well,
because I think there is this fear with sex, right? And it can really limit us.
Yeah. When I was a teenager, I hit puberty at 16, and in my mind, the first woman I had sex with was probably going to be my wife, and we'd be together forever.
And if that didn't happen, something went horribly wrong, and you're a bad person.
Well, even worse than that, I made no moves until I was sure that that was the person I thought that I would be with. So I didn't have any girlfriend in high school. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why all of this happened, but you know, I was in the military, and I hit 22 and was getting out, still a virgin, and there's something just occurred. I went, well, this is silly. I mean, we need sex like we need water and sleep and food and to go to the bathroom and all those things. It's a normal part of the human experience.
It is a normal part of the human experience. I mean, I think that we need touch in the same way that we need food. I mean, no one ever dies from not having sex immediately. But I think that you do need it over time, and I think you do need touch and physical sensation. There are people who are asexual.
Right. I've been paying attention to that. And, yeah, it's true. We don't die from not having sex, but I think the ramifications...
babies die from not being touched.
Right. The ramifications of not having that element of your life taken care of if you're not asexual can... Maybe there's not a direct effect, but there's some... ancillary connections.
Yeah, something that's really lost in the human experience.
Yeah, and I think scientists have done studies, at least in the psychology realm, that not developing emotionally affects your brain development. I mean, you almost regress in development if you don't have the emotional component taken care of.
So how did the practice of stroking every day in this group, how did that affect your emotional life?
Well, I'd say the practice itself didn't necessarily do anything, but what the other things connected to doing the practice and being in a community of people also engaged in the practice and more or less with the same intention and being in the community, that made me more socially connected, more socially aware, or how to communicate. I just got better at communicating. I don't think I've ever had a very good process of communicating, particularly with women. With guys, it wasn't a big deal. I'm a guy.
Right.
But women
you don't really need to communicate too much.
Right. We just grunt at each other. And
I'm just teasing.
But they're definitely, I guess because of my fear when I was younger, I didn't make efforts. I didn't take chances. Embarrassment was hard to deal with, shame and all of that. So it cascaded, but by the time I hit 25, I realized, you know, my life's not going to go anywhere if I don't learn how to talk to women. So I did that, and I worked on that, but this oming practice, or the practice
stroking.
I was doing, the stroking practice that I was doing, it just opened up some avenues and some doors that I was able to explore that I otherwise would not have explored. And the experience supercharged my ability to, I guess, cover all the social gaps that I had. Yeah, and then I just took it more scientifically in terms of, well, if there's something occurring that you're not sure what it does or why it does what it does, you grab it, you experiment it, and see with what it does. Only direct experience can tell you what something does. Although, you know, there's a spiritual component to how I live, I don't live purely by faith. I live by experiment. Well, what does that do? I don't know. Let's see.
Right.
And that's what it taught me.
And so your experience stroking women really helped you connect with them emotionally? How did that work? Because, I mean, you're just thinking that this is a practice of you putting your hand on a woman's genitals for 15 minutes, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did that make you connect emotionally?
Well, that's purely subjective. I think for some women, if I already had an emotional connection, I think it fleshed it out in more dimensions. If it was someone I didn't really connect with beyond the stroking, it didn't improve the connection. But for me, it allowed me a greater awareness of what I could feel them differently. Mm-hmm. For me, my experience was I felt differently. Without having to touch, there was just this sense of something. And if I wasn't sure, I wouldn't guess that. I would say, hey, is blah, blah, blah going on with you? And they go, well, how did you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh. It's almost like there's a palpable sensation around us all the time where that practice just made me aware of how subtle it was. And so I could, and also with the previous experience with Vipassana, I just would stop and just breathe into it. Just stop and breathe into it and go, you know, it's this simple. If you're in a very high humidity area of the country or the world, it just feels hot. It's not like you need a thermometer. Everybody goes, damn, it feels hot.
Yeah.
And so it's that sort of thing. There's just this palpable sensation in the air. And I attribute it to maybe emotional states being broadcast.
Yeah, I think that we have the tools to really understand people's emotions so much more keenly than we're aware. And if we're always up in our head and in our own ego trip and our dialogue and not present in the moment and not really paying attention to the person with whom we're speaking, mm-hmm. then we miss those subtle sensations. And I think there's also something about, instead of trying to fix someone, you know, then instead of just, you know, just letting go of your expectation about needing to fix or whatever, you can just be with them where they are.
Yeah.
And I think that's also something really helpful about, you know, becoming more present in the moment.
Yeah.
Do you think that was connected with your experience at all?
In some sense, yeah. Definitely there was, yeah, just I'd have to say it's just a greater awareness mm-hmm. of what's going on around me. And and how subtle it can be.
Yeah.
And it's just as subtle as human communication. It's not what you say, it's how you say it.
Yeah, as we're sitting here talking about the subtleties of what's going on around you, there's people taking off their clothes and kissing and putting on different clothes and hugging and slapping each other. And so if you ever hear a little slapping sound in the background, that's probably someone smacking someone else's really cute tush. See? Oh, good stuff. But it's interesting how, like, sex, like, actual sex is related to being present in the moment. I mean, good sex, I mean, it really helps if you're present.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can feel things you might not otherwise feel. How often do you get to touch someone in certain ways that normally you wouldn't think were available?
Right.
So why would you waste it thinking about baseball?
How jiggly something is, or whether or not they really like you, or I don't know what guys think about. Do they ever worry? Maybe they're afraid that this means commitment, or I don't know. What do guys think about when they're having sex?
I'd say there's probably a theme for most guys, but I'd say it's as different as what women think about.
Right, right. Per experience, per woman, per...
Yeah, it's experiential, yeah. And it's who you are. I mean, I don't know what I think about during sex. I can't remember right now.
Because right now just you think about it. Doing it. Yes, yeah, you think about what you're doing right now, and you're like, "Ooh, this is awesome."
And I'm more process oriented, which then goes back to cooking. The process of cooking is what fascinates me, and what I enjoy. I mean, something as simple as cutting vegetables is actually quite enjoyable, and the repetition of it is there's something soothing in it. Mm. I don't know if that's occurred since I did Vipassana, but and also the stroking meditation I did. But definitely there's this way that the process is what's offered. And ultimately, to me, that's what sex is. Sex is a process. The climax is the culmination of the process for that particular period of time until you engage in the process again. But in the act of engaging in the process, at every moment as you progress through the process, there's some place that's calling your attention.
Mm-hmm.
That in the connection with the person, the individual, the other human being that you're with. And I think that's what makes sex really fun.
Yeah, let's explore that a little bit more. Because, I mean, we're talking about connection and communication and being present so that you can be aware of what's going on. But let's talk about how receptivity is connected to this connection and exploring, like, you really have to be receptive. And what, how can you be more receptive? How can you be less guarded?
Well, there was a moment during a setting where I didn't understand what vulnerability was. It really pissed me off.
Vulnerability pissed you off? You're like, that's weak.
Yeah.
I'm not into it.
Yeah, totally. Based on my military experience, the idea of
course.
The idea of being weak or submissive just didn't resonate with me.
Yeah, it's dangerous.
Yeah, and I'm not really that kind of person. I mean, but I am receptive. I am a team player and I'm an individual. So in order to be a team player, you sort of have to let go of your ego trips, at least to have a successful team experience. But what happened is somebody explained vulnerability to me and said, hey, it's just sharing what your feelings are without making the other person's problem. And that was like a lightning bolt of information for me, because since then, and that was some 5-6 years ago, that's what I practice. I say what I feel, particularly in relationship. So that's been very important for me in the experience of, I guess, what sex is and what makes it fun.
Mm.
Being vulnerable is important.
Did the sense of receptibility or vulnerability affect your martial arts practice?
Oh, absolutely. And there's been a back and forth in that, because it's a physical practice. And the receptivity has really shown me that it's at the higher levels of the martial experience, of the martial arts experience. As a fighter, it's not so much blocking as it is evading and entering, or...
Like, I accept that you're hitting me, and I'm squeaking out of your way.
Well, I accept that you intend to do something forceful in my direction, and I can decide whether I wanted you to allow you to do it, or whether I want to deflect it or completely disregard it because I've done something that overrides what you're doing. But
because you're aware of what
right,
I'm doing.
Right, exactly. You're aware. So the awareness opens up. And receptivity, I think, is really important because it's listening. So there's a way you can listen with your ears and there's a way you can listen with your body, meaning all five senses. You can listen with all five senses. And this goes back to being present in the moment. If you're present in the moment, all five senses are working as one to take in information. And that's what our eyes, ears, nose, mouth, skin, that's what they do. They take in information directly and feed it to the brain. So without interpretation, it's just pure information. We put emotional interpretations on things because of whatever our programming is around an experience. And I got past preferences. So there was a certain, at a time, you could say I had a type of woman.
Oh, yeah? Like a, you only like this one type?
Curvy brunettes,
sure.
Let's say. And for a time, I had a fetish with redheads. But now, and I didn't understand until I, and when I understood I was having a fetish, I was like, oh, wow, this is what it's like not to see someone as a human being.
Oh, no. Yeah. I know. That's why I surprised myself by objectifying a woman one time, too. And I was like, oh, no. And then I asked for her permission. And she's like, it's fine. And I was like, shoo. That was really helpful.
Yeah. And that's, but that's interesting, too, though, because conscious objectification is different than programmed objectification.
Yeah, for sure.
Where it's just reflexive. So now I can be aware and I go, well, you see someone and they like the feeling of you admiring them. And there's not this maybe darker urges behind it. You're just realizing you're turned on by this person for whatever reason.
Right. And you may not know the deeper things about who they are and their spirit and their personality and their intelligence. And it may not even need to matter to you at that moment. You accept that it's there somewhere lurking underneath the surface, but you want to lick the surface.
Yeah, I want to lick the surface. Yeah.
And it's interesting, like, as we're talking about consciousness and taking information into our brain and feeding ourselves, we're using all these metaphors that are about consumption and food. Mm-hmm. And so, like, there are all these ways that food and consciousness and sex are related.
Absolutely. We exist in this body right here, right now. So there are things that it needs for sustenance. And there's multiple levels of sustenance, some of which we know, some of which our science can define and point to, and others that we just know this is how it works. All I know is if I don't get this, I feel this way. Mm-hmm. If I don't get some sex, I'm grouchy.
But you can probably masturbate. Does that help? Are you still grouchy?
It helps to a degree, but there's an element of human interaction that I think is important in the experience of sex. So masturbation probably will take the edge off, mm-hmm. or you can make love to yourself, but there's a subtle energy dynamic. There's a polarity, a magnetism that happens with another human being or a couple of human beings or more. That
pile.
I think we all each have our own maybe energy signature, for the lack of a better description. Mm-hmm. And so we each bring a different frequency, a different vibration of existence to the experience of each other. So I can masturbate the rest of my life, but as I experienced when I was younger, it was actually taking me out of the social environment rather than bringing me in. It was isolating me more. It was segregating me more. Mm-hmm. Now, that was me. Now, maybe for some people, it doesn't change anything. My personal experiences became a crutch. So then having interaction with other people actually energizes me and helps my creativity.
I think that there's so many things about masturbation. My experience with masturbation is that it helped me get me into my body and loving pleasure, and so that was it was actually a really helpful practice. I actually didn't do it enough. Like, I would maybe do it once a year at some points in my life, and there was a part of my life where I was super religious and I didn't do it for 5 years at all, and I was pining away and I was like in puberty and like desperate for touch, and I was like, I'm covered in skin. Why did God cover me in skin and I can't have sex? And I was like trying to get, you know, I was like, I need to get married. That's the answer. I need to get married. Okay. Who's going to marry me? It was so healthy.
Woo! Wow. Yeah.
I'm teasing.
Okay. That's fantastic.
I know, it was awesome. Amen. Praise the Lord. Woo. However, okay, so here we go back to the need for sex. And here's the thing that I sometimes, you know, come up against. You know, we have this idea that, you know, we have sex partners and this person is the only person that I have sex with. And so this person is my only outlet for sex. And sometimes then when we need sex and that person isn't available, then that's when this kind of becomes a problem, because a lot of people aren't open. You know, they're not like, you know, they're like, I'm emotionally set down. I don't want to have sex, but you can't have sex with anyone else. Whoa.
Yeah, that prison doesn't appeal to me.
Yeah.
Not in any sense. And I'm currently seeing somebody who has a lot of options, shall we say. but what makes the relationship work for me is that she does take care. She has consideration. And that's the big difference. So, I mean, I think over a period of a couple of weeks, I've only seen her 3 or 4 times. And she's out making her rounds with the connections she has. And that's great. I would never think to try to change that in her for my sake. And I think part of it, too, is for me, it's important to be whole within myself, to know how to feed myself or find sustenance for myself in that emotional realm.
Yeah, I think it's just hard for people that, you know, when they think that, oh, I need sex, I need to have sex right now, I need to have sex with you. But if that other person isn't receptive to sex for whatever reason, that's when there's this big, scary disconnect, you know, because there are these relationships that people have that they're like, well, you're my husband, you're supposed to have sex with me, or you're my wife and you're supposed to have sex with me, or whatever, or I've bought you dinner, you have to have sex with me. You know what I mean? And we do need sex as human beings, but we don't need sex from this person right now if they're not ready.
Well, yeah, in my mind, marriage, the way most people express marriage is, I don't want to say this.
Super unhealthy and creepy? I mean, I shouldn't say that. Sorry.
Well, that's one. I was going to be a little friendlier. It's sort of pre-programmed expectation.
Right.
That's the way
it's
been experienced.
Huge obligation. Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess this generation that I'm part of, I was born in mid-60s. Even people who were born in the realm of me still carry on that 50s mentality of this is the way things are. But I think Generation X, they're redefining what relationship is. And truth be told, even that monogamous paradigm was a lie, because how many people were having affairs?
Cheating, 36%.
Yeah, so.
And that's 30, and many of those people were in happy marriages.
Right.
Like they were satisfied with their relationships.
Right, and being satisfied with a relationship is not one dimension of experience. There's multiple dimensions of experience. And I don't think any one person can cover every need I have. And it's true. I mean, the woman I'm seeing, there's a certain areas of my life experience that we don't relate on. But that's no reason not to have the relationship, because there are other areas that are really fun that we really connect well on over and over and over again. And not just sex, just because I'm able to listen better as a guy. I think she feels a lot more comfortable expressing herself. So, and I get the experience of having someone be vulnerable with me on a deep level, which is fulfilling for me, because I understand vulnerability, and that's something that I've always enjoyed in my life. I just didn't know what to explain it as before. So if women can be around me and feel comfortable and feel expressive and open, then that's major bonus for me.
Yeah, totally. And it's almost like a conversation, even sexually, like intercourse and discourse, you know, they're the same word, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's really important to think about, like, when, because sometimes, have you ever been having sex and then you just know what the other person wants and you just feel it and you touch mm-hmm. them there and they're like, oh my God, that's just what I wanted.
Yeah.
Do you know, like, it's like yeah. this conversation.
Yeah, there's a rhythm. Mm-hmm. And good conversations have a rhythm. I read the Celestine Prophecy years and years and years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a section in it where he was sitting down with, I guess it might have been a Vipassana experience, but there was one part of the book they were talking, and it was just the awareness he had of, well, now it's my time to talk. And then there was the other person's time to talk. And there was just this flow. And I've tried to experience my participation in conversations that way, like really paying attention. Okay, now I want to say something. And most of the time people will talk over each other trying to get out what they
right,
want to say
but
rather
then the other
than
the person's not listening to you anyway.
Right. And that's the other part. But what if everybody's listening first?
Right.
Then to me that's a real conversation because you're taking in the information and then making a decision of what to say next based on what you heard, not on what you think you heard. Because you weren't listening in the first place.
Yeah, right.
You only got hit a buzz or trigger word. You're like, well, no, wait a minute. This was, and you're like, that's not what I said. Well, yes, you did. You said, actually, that was your perception of what I said. That's not what
based
I said.
Based on your pain and your previous experiences
right.
and your disappointments and your anger with, you know, or resentments. Or,
right.
You know,
yeah, so at this stage, all of the practices I've engaged in have imbued me with some level of patience and awareness of being attentive by listening and to talk less than I listen.
Has it affected your cooking practice at all?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Looking at a recipe or coming up with an idea for flavors. Yeah, all of those things, there's a flow to it. It's much easier, and I'm much more willing to make mistakes. Oh, that doesn't taste good. No, I'm not doing that again.
Right.
But
or just letting something be what it is. Like maybe you wanted it to be fluffy and blue, yeah. and it's flat and green.
Yeah, no, well. I throw that away. No.
Yeah, maybe I'm just more frugal.
Yeah.
I'm always like, oh, it's soup. I'm sure it's fine.
Well, if it's for me, yeah, I'll put it, you know, I'll eat. Most things that I make, even if they blow up in my face.
Right.
But this is the part where my ego is involved. I'm like, no, I want people.
Oh, well, here, certainly.
Well, and two, with food as with sex, I want people to be pleased by their experience with me.
Sure.
To walk away
I bet
going,
you could probably screw it up pretty well, and it'd still be pretty good. Still be
maybe.
Okay.
We'll see. I want people to go, I want to do that with him again. Yeah, with some good French toast, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Arugula, baby.
Yeah.
And French toast. No, that's important, too.
Yes.
I just like arugula a lot. And you use
I love
it
arugula.
Here all the time.
Yeah,
did
yeah.
you know it's an aphrodisiac?
I did not know that.
It is.
Oh. Female friend turned me on to it, so to speak.
Yes. Well, and it's really super good for you and has that nice peppery bite.
Yeah, it comes with buttery and peppery.
Mm.
It's a really good green to have. And greens are really important just overall for health. So besides flavor and pleasure, I'm also looking to have food be healthful. And to
because it's about the body.
Exactly, because you can't have more sex if you're not
yeah,
in good shape.
All you eat is foie gras. a little bit of foie gras is good, but too much.
Yeah.
Woo.
And if you have good sex, you want to eat. So you better, it's a nice, tight circle.
Oh, man, those days when you just have sex and eat all day.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You're like, now I'm hungry again.
Yes.
Oh, hang on.
Yeah, you burn off the calories and you get them back.
You get them back.
You burn off.
Totally.
That's a nice weekend, right?
Yeah.
4-day weekend.
Oh, Ken, it's such a pleasure to chat with you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for sitting me down and talking to me.
Yeah, finally got you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Almost another hour of sex intellectual interviews from the 8-course gourmet dinner still to come. With Midori, San Francisco's sluttiest blogger, and more Bay Area sex-positive glitterati. We'll talk about everything from how to be more sexually empowered, divining your partner's fantasies, why the caviar service here isn't just scandalously culinarily incorrect, but so mind-blowingly good. Mm. 2, which household items are safe for sex play and which ones aren't. You can make sure you get the next episode of Sexploration with Monica by subscribing on iTunes. And you can always download the next free episode on sexplorationwithmonica.com.